Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing the creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
All across the transatlantic, there's a lot of wasted time and false debate between these dual extremes that people think that if you're a liberal, I tend to have to adopt a Keynesian view of solutions when I'm in an economic crisis, a top-down view. On the opposite extreme, there's a lot of very good people who tend to be of a more conservative-minded bent and are of the view, no, government has been the problem. Look at all of the disasters government has done, all of this incompetent spending, bailing out the banks. And they'll find all of these malpractices of national governments. And their conclusion is, no government. We need just bottom-up. The solution is bottom-up, not top-down, bottom-up. In both cases, there are elements of truth, which is why both teams are attractive to be a part of, but both are also missing a fundamental principle of reality. It's neither top-down, nor is it bottom-up.
History happens. Economics is a fabrication. And therein lies the mission of this program, which makes it our business to study the relationship between the two and how it creates our world events. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today's guest, whose comments opened this program, is Matthew Arrett, an author of numerous volumes on economic history, a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow, and a noted expert on the American system of banking, which is one of Ellen's more recent focuses. This topic has become all the more timely as our nation addresses how it intends to finance the many layers of economic recovery that are now required to move the U.S. forward past the impacts of the pandemic, as well as the dire condition of our infrastructure. As we've discussed previously on this program, the American system of bank finance appears to hold the greatest promise for massive new investment. Now, the American system we're talking about is the one that was created by Alexander Hamilton, in which the government monetized its debt to create new government funding, which enabled us to finance the Civil War, World Wars I and II, and the New Deal, and all that resulted from that. So Matthew Arrett will give us a detailed walk through the historical factors that led to the American system and the countervailing theories that emerged, and which continue to play an outsized role in our economic thinking, and caused a pitched battle between simplistic sides of top-down or bottom-up economics. We'll visit with Matthew Arrett in a few moments. But Ellen has been reviewing a recent unusual phenomenon in the world of finance, a virtual populist uprising that has taken and placed in temporary check the unrestrained power center of Wall Street. Let's talk to Ellen now.
Ellen, we're seeing all kinds of populist uprisings around the world, and one of the really interesting ones that has happened in the U.S. in the last couple of weeks, I guess, is the subject of your latest article, which you've titled "Game On with GameStop: Beating Wall Street at Its Own Game." That's a good title. What's it about?
Okay, well, probably most people who've read the headlines already know, because it's been in the financial news for the last week or so. GameStop is a gaming store, a video game store that's a retailer in malls. So it's a physical store that was verging on bankruptcy, and it's the most heavily shorted stock in the stock market, but beloved of the young gamers and the young new class of investors who have jumped into the stock market. So what happened was there were 2 million members of this Reddit group or a subreddit group called Wall Street Bets, and they discussed among themselves that they were going to save their their favorite game store. And so this is the most heavily short-sold stock on the market. And so they jumped in and bought and drove the price of the stock way up and cost the hedge funds that had driven the stock down a lot of money, billions of dollars. As of last Wednesday, it had cost them $26 billion. And
wow.
The stock went back up after the platform where it was traded blocked the young people or the whatever you want to call them,
the gamers.
The young retail investors from, they couldn't buy, they could only sell, but the hedge funds were allowed to buy to cover their bets. And so the hedge funds did jump in and cover their bets. It cost them a lot of money, but it did mean that that was the top. And so unfortunately, some of the biggest winners out of this whole thing was our favorite villains, J.P. Morgan Chase and BlackRock and Goldman Sachs, because they saw what was happening. And, of course, they're sophisticated investors, and they jumped in early and bought, and then they sold at the top and made something like 700%. And some of the biggest losers will be some of these smaller gamers, because a lot of young people just jumped in. They maybe only had a few $100s, and they jumped in with that. And would lose it all if they were the last in, or if they are the last to sell after it drops way down, they're going to lose their money. And the rule, of course, always is don't bet more than you can afford to lose. But young investors don't necessarily. I mean, the young investors always lose money to start with because they don't really know what they're doing. But anyway, it was supposedly a sort of a grassroots movement. It's been called Occupy, or Max Kaiser calls it Occupy 2.0, and there's this group of young Republicans who have called it Reoccupy Wall Street, and they were protesting when the regulators didn't allow the young traders to buy. So that was last weekend. They were out in the snow there in New York protesting.
Oh, well.
And it is actually an occupation by Wall Street. To occupy Wall Street, the young people made a big impression, and they were successful in changing the attitude toward who was at fault for the 2008 crisis. So Occupy Wall Street, of course, is in 2010. But they didn't really have much impact on Wall Street because they didn't really get in there. But now these young traders have gotten in there and have played. And what they've demonstrated is that there is unity in strength, that the 99% can easily overwhelm the 1% if they get together. Now, there are a few shady aspects of this. Apparently, it wasn't totally spontaneous. There was a sophisticated investor who is a licensed trader who was part of that Reddit group who sort of, you know, led the charge. But it's not clear that there was anything illegal going on. What's called market manipulation is when you do something fraudulent, like you go on the news, like you're a big company and you go on the news and say things about your product that aren't true, and then investors jump in and so that's a fraud, and that's you're pumping and dumping based on fraudulent information. But this Reddit group, they were totally open, you know, everybody could see what they were doing. It was all there on their social media platform saying what they were doing, and they did it. So that's not actually illegal to agree that you're all going to buy something, even though the purpose was, in fact, to get the big hedge funds. And they did get some big hedge funds. So anyway, it was, you know, quite dramatic. And to me, the implications that we've actually been at war with Wall Street for longer than since 2010. It goes all the way back to the 19th century. Or you could, if you want to call Wall Street the big banks, it goes back to the 18th century with the big British banks that had captured the colonies, basically, with the controlled their financial well-being until the American colonists figured out how to break loose. They printed their own money, and then they did their own banks. There was the Pennsylvania Bank, the land bank. This is in Benjamin Franklin's time, that issued credit, and then so that's what Matt will be talking about more. The whole American system, where you're actually creating the credit to build stuff, and then the productivity of the loans pays back the debt, and so that's a more sustainable system than just printing money and pumping it out there. But anyway, we the people have definitely triumphed historically before against Wall Street, and I would say we can do it again. And so this was certainly a wake-up call for the hedge funds. They'll probably be changing the rules about short selling. Did I explain what short selling is? Short selling is when you borrow stocks from a broker, and these are stocks basically when you sign up for a broker, you agree in the fine print in those contracts of adhesion that they make you sign that nobody really reads, you agree that they can lend your stocks. So basically the brokers are lending the stock of their clients, and then the short seller is assuming the stock is going to go down, or if they're big, like there's several hedge funds that get together in private and decide they're going to attack a certain stock, or they've even done this with whole countries, like that's what they did with Greece, and Goldman Sachs led the charge in that case. I wrote an article about that like quite a while ago, 10 years ago or so. Anyway, so that hedge funds or whatever get together and they all sell at once, and then that drives the price of the stock down. And a naked short sale is when they don't even cover, they don't even borrow the stock first. And the idea is to drive the stock into the ground so that the company goes bankrupt, and then they never have to cover because there's nobody to collect because the business is bankrupt. But anyway, so that was the game that these young gamers figured out. And the reason they were able to do it and they haven't done it before is, first of all, there's the internet and the connectivity that we've gotten over the last 20 years, where people can talk with each other and learn from each other. And then there's the fact that these online brokerages that are commission free. And so young people can afford to play the game. And they've changed some other rules. Like it used to be, if you wanted to buy something like Tesla, you had to buy the whole share of stock. And some young people just wouldn't even have the money. But now you can just buy a share of stock. So you can buy a few dollars worth so young people can get in.
And there are markets, of course, there are all kinds of markets, but the cryptocurrency markets are also places where there's a lot of youth engagement and other engagement from the street level, where more people are getting into markets, market investing of one sort or another.
Yeah, and that is also considered part of this populist young people's revolution, or as Gerald Celente called it, he called it the youth revolution. So they can see that the American dream has been taken from them. There are no jobs. That's the other thing that happened in the last year, of course, was the shutdowns, the lockdowns that mean that all these young people are sitting at home, so they have time to study up. Learn the stock market. It's quite complicated, but if you want to spend all day on it, you can learn how to learn the ropes and learn how to play. And they got a little extra money with the $1,200 they got last year, and now I guess there's another $600 plus the unemployment money, so they've got some money to play with that they didn't have before. So you have actual literally kids jumping in and playing this game, and they're gamers. They're already trained in. I mean, they've spent their youth learning things like algorithms that our generation maybe isn't necessarily all that confident with.
Saturday Night Live did a great bit on the glamorous life of the day trader, you know, and they would show pictures and videos of couples fancy all dressed up partying and drinking and having a great time. And then they would flash to today's day trader. It was some young person sitting on a really ugly couch doing his toenails and eating Cheetos, but making making bets, you know, and how different that has become, how populous this interest and this engagement has become. And so we are really witnessing this transformative moment, or at least this morphing of the money realities and control and engagement, where people were excluded unless they had property or means, that they didn't get to participate. And now, you know, we see all these different fronts of populist involvement, including public banking, of course, and the various moves that are within the legislatures to bring the power and access to money back to the people, maybe for the first time, although, you know, a couple hundred years ago, the Quakers and the colonists that were making their own money. When you mentioned that, Ellen, I was thinking of how in the 18th century, when the British Bank, I guess the Bank of England got started back then, when they were playing, keeping the colonists by a chain of financial control and limitation, that's the thing that started the American Revolution. As we've said before, right, at least according to Benjamin Franklin, right, not having access to that.
Right,
and
when
here
they
we are
shut
again.
Down the paper scrip, they forbade the colonies to issue their own money, yeah.
And now we have new variations of that. I think as you say in your article, this great quote from the 19th century from Mary Ellen Lease about Wall Street, that Wall Street, and this is what, 1890, she says, I'm going to quote from your article here, Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. The great common people of this country are slaves, and monopoly is the master. Well, that's inspiring. She was a fiery, fiery person, but boy, you know, hit it on the head, and it's the same lament, it's the same complaint that we have now structurally, that big money runs and controls everything.
Yeah, and it's been so blatant in the last year, where the stock market is the only place, the stock market has been going up and up, and so these billionaires are doubling their money while you've got all these millions of people who are out of work, small businesses that are being shut down for no fault of their own, just this regulation that came out of the blue. So, yeah, the divide between rich and poor is getting bigger and bigger, and the poor are getting more and more educated on what's really going on because they've got the time now to sit in front of their computers and learn all this stuff.
Yes, and one commentator, Leah Downey, who's a PhD candidate at Harvard Government, points out that there is this fair banking rule that has issued during the past session of Congress, I guess, was to prevent banks from being prohibited to invest in things like fossil fuels and private prisons and things that are detrimental to the environment and others, and they're pushing back against that, saying that, well, you know, bankers are the ones who need to be making the calls on who should be issuing credit and responsible for that, and that they should be able to redline basically because they realize a good customer versus one that can't be counted to repay. That question. It came down to this. She says, on what basis should we create and disseminate credit? That this is the conversation that the United States needs to have, frankly, directly, and among all parties. So I think it feels like banking the movement, that we are in the middle of that process. We're starting to, you know, to redesign, reconfigure some of the banking institutions that we count on, and it's very exciting. I mean, public banking is making great progress around the country these days.
Yeah, well, and you could impose regulations on the big Wall Street banks and say they can only lend for XYZ. But the easier, more direct thing to do is to form your own publicly owned banks that have it in their charters that they are required to serve the public interest in various ways, however you want to do it. But anyway, it's something that's in the control of the people so that they can choose themselves where their credit is going to go.
Yeah, so that our banking institutions and our lending potential really comes is given and put into the hands of the people, and that the people who now control it, the private capital interests that control it, should be parceled out of that market in an appropriate way that allows them to continue to do the kind of speculative business they do. I don't mean financial specialization, but you know, to be able to extend credit on their terms, but that we, the people, actually can and should, along the lines of the American system, lend ourselves the credit based on the monetizing our equity, which is what built this country, which is, of course, starting to frame the architecture of infrastructure banking, which we've been talking about, we will talk more about in the near future. Well, Ellen, your conversation with Matt Arendt is very interesting. He's a very knowledgeable guy. That there's so much history to learn here. We'd better get on and do it because you had a nice lengthy conversation with him.
Okay.
So thank you.
Great talking to you.
Good talking to you, Ellen.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Matthew Arendt, who is in Montreal, Canada. He's the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review, senior fellow at the American University in Moscow, Belt and Road Initiative expert on tactical talk, and has authored three volumes of the Untold History of Canada book series. In 2019, he co-founded the Montreal-based Rising Tide Foundation. So, Matthew, it's great to talk to you. You've written a three-part series on the American system of money and banking. You kindly cited me in the first paragraph. So I've gone into the American system a lot, but you've actually gone into it in more depth than I have. So that's what I'd love to talk about, how we can apply that today or get back to our original principles. We have so much civil unrest right now. We have such a divided country. And it seems to me that one thing that can or should unite us is our founding principles. We can go back to our history that we all share and we all feel, we all agree about that, hopefully, about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and so forth, and about the economic system on which our country was based, which was, my understanding of the American system is basically it's government issued money and credit. So right now we have banker issued credit or money issued as credit by banks. And we have a central bank controlled system with the central banks all part of an international network that our Congress, that they've actually declared their independence.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly we the people have very little control or leverage over that. But you in Canada have also from 1937 to 1973 at least had a very strong Bank of Canada, which was government-owned and that was used to rebuild the country. So anyway, you've gone into this at length, and I'd love to hear your views on how we can get back to that original system and use it to solve these very serious crises, economic crises that we have right now.
Oh, yes. That's a really great opening. Thank you for that generous introduction. And also, thank you for writing that article, because honestly, in many ways, that is what spurred me on to produce my trilogy. A lot, it's demoralizing a little bit, because whether it's in Canada, it's more acute in the US, but it's also in Europe, all across the transatlantic, there's a lot of false wasted time and false debate between these polarities, these dual extremes that people think that if you're a liberal, I'm a sort of left-minded, I'm a more, you know, moral type of thinker, then if I feel that way, I tend to have to adopt a Keynesian view of solutions when I'm in an economic crisis, a top-down view. So printing money to sustain people, infrastructure, there's a lot of sympathy towards that stuff, but there's a view, okay, it's got to be top-down. Free markets have created enough problems. Privatizations have created enough problems for the past 5 decades. We don't need any more of that. There's too much unbounded freedom. I would say that there's a lot of truth in that, but there's some fallacies, some Trojan horses that are also embedded in that discussion. On the opposite extreme, there's a lot of patriots, a lot of very good people I've encountered, whether it's in Canada, the US, or Europe, who tend to be of a more conservative-minded bent, and are of the view, no, government has been the problem. Look at all of the disasters government has done, all of this incompetent spending, bailing out the banks that's obviously produced a hyperinflationary process that's going to blow out the economy. That doesn't work. And they'll find all of these abuses or malpractices of national government. And their conclusion is no government. We need just bottom up. The solution is bottom up, not top down, bottom up. Get rid of all national top down constraints. So in both cases, I would say there are elements of truth, which is why both teams are attractive to be a part of, but both are also missing a fundamental principle of reality that has shaped much of recent history from the American Revolution, even before the American Revolution, as you get through in your article onward. And in your article, I just loved how you were able to just condensely, in a very short space, examine the origins and the evolution of the American system of political economy, which today many people try to categorize it into some prefixed category that they're comfortable with. And it's neither top down nor is it bottom up. It uses principles of national planning, national banking, national regulation. That's true. Those things are used. Does that make it some radical socialist Marxist thing? No, it's not that at all. Because whenever it's been applied, and there's always been a fight, it's never been, we call it the American system, but it's never been fully operational for very long. And when it has worked, it's been sabotaged. So when you look at it, you have to sort of be sensitive to that dynamic that there has been intentional sabotage from 1776, even before that, like I said, onward to the present day. Usually, if you want to see get an entry point into examining it, you could look at the presidents who tend to die while in office. There's been 8 of them. It's just the same. Just look at what they're doing, whether it's Harrison or whether it's Lincoln or whether it's McKinley or Garfield or Warren Harding or Roosevelt or JFK. Just look at what they're doing. Look at their policies and look at who's opposing their policies and who they're opposing. What power structures are they threatening to move the power away from? And these are people from, as you heard these names from both parties, right? Left, Democrat, Republican. It's something that's trans-party. Under those periods, you have blossomings of free enterprise, of private capital. You have free markets even exist in different ways. So you have a blossoming of these, the idea of individual liberty being expressed in reality, while at the same time, paradoxically for some, you have national controls. Okay, so for some people, that their minds can't compute that because they've been so wired by whether it's Keynesian economic theorists or whether it's Austrian school libertarian theorists to try to define the past from these preset false categories. They can't understand what is it exactly that was being reactivated with John F. Kennedy or being reactivated earlier with Franklin Roosevelt under the New Deal and his battles with the bankers in London. Who wanted a world government controlled by central bankers in 1933 during the London conference, or his Wall Street battles to break up the Wall Street banks with Glass-Steagall. What was that McKinley was trying to do with his programs of 1896 for the Republican Party platform of a protective policy with an investment into manufacturing? What was that Lincoln was doing with his greenback policy and the infrastructure investments that were ultimately sabotaged that should have gone on to reconstruction of the South? Or earlier with Hamilton, or his mentor, Benjamin Franklin, or his mentors, Cotton Mather, any of the original leaders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony of the 17th century. It doesn't fit. You have to sort of shed the ideologies of top down or bottom up. London School of Economics, because I mean, again, this whole thing really, this debate between Keynes versus Hayek, as I go through in my series, it really does emanate from the London School of Economics, Cambridge, Oxford trifecta in 1932 that artificially created this false debate, knowing that Franklin Roosevelt was likely going to be elected by November 1932. And it not only confused people back then, because I got to tell you, Roosevelt was not a Keynesian, okay? We're told he was. I am aware of that might be a controversial thing to say. But he thought and said on record that he thought Keynes was a mathematician and not an economist. Keynes thought that he was an economic incompetent. Frances Perkins writes this in her biography of Franklin Roosevelt. There's something more going on. And that's what I tried to get across in this trilogy, the soul of this American tradition that's been suppressed and scrubbed out of our history books and our economic textbooks. It's very hard to investigate this, but you were able to get across what this was from Benjamin Franklin to Hamilton to John Jay, Henry Clay, Henry C. Carey, Matthew Carey, Lincoln, McKinley. Like, there's been this continuity of battle, and it's not socialist again, and it's not free market, laissez-faire capitalism. It's something else. It's a different species of thinking.
I think today the closest model we have to the American system is the Chinese system, which, you know, what we don't want to adopt their totalitarian, I mean, that's way too top down, but their economic system is the government issues the money and the government issues the credit. The government owns the banks, and therefore they can build, you know, all sorts of, well, like 12,000 miles of high-speed rail in 10 years. How do they do it? They just issue the credit, build the thing, the fees, pay back the loan. And that's more or less the model of HR 6422, the National Infrastructure Bill that I was writing about, which would be copying Roosevelt's Reconstruction Finance Corporation, basically. So all that is good. And I've actually read and thought what I would write about next is the Chinese digital yuan, the central bank digital yuan, which 80% of central banks supposedly are going to be issuing their own digital currencies soon. And the Chinese are way ahead of us, and they're already testing it. They've already got all the software for it, which we don't. So they're way ahead of us. But the thing is, now that they've got that, they can then just issue loans as much as there is a demand for all around the world. And of course, they already have a big network of countries that are borrowing from them, because unlike the IMF, which has loans with strings attached, you know, they force you into austerity if you're going to borrow from the IMF. Yeah. The Chinese are, you know, they're more favorable creditors. And now if they can just issue their money directly, easily through a digital currency, they could well take over the dollar as global reserve currency. I wrote years ago that, because I quoted somebody who said that the Chinese got that system from Henry Carey in Lincoln's time when they had a close relationship with China. And I wrote that somewhere, and some Chinese person said, we had government issued money 1,000 years before you did, or I don't remember when, but they, you know, they originally issued their own money long ago. So really even claim authorship over this. But I know you've written about the Belt and Road and so forth, and that Canada should join the Belt and Road system. But how can we fix this globally? Because we've got a serious global issue besides our domestic issues. We could do it both ways, it seems to me. But yeah. The question is, who controls it? I know many people, experts that I like and that I, you know, don't want to offend, are quite sure that the plan here is to get us all hooked on this digital currency, and then they will turn it off if we don't comply with the rules. So it's a form of control. It's a form of enslavement. Obviously, don't want that, but the premise is good. So what do you think?
Well, I think that, yeah, this, what you've just said is just so, there's so many places you can go with it. But I think the thing that sprung to my mind is the question of value. I mean, I think everyone has an experience sometimes talking to somebody where you're both English speakers or whatever languages you're speaking in, and you're using a lot of the same words, but you discover very quickly that even though your words are the same, let's say you're talking about economics or banking, you're discovering that the ideas associated with the words are totally different. It's like this person lives in a different universe. Oftentimes people will mistakenly think that a debt is a debt is a debt, right? That a dollar invested in a person who digs random holes and fills them back up again is getting a paycheck. And that paycheck is going to pay for their food, which is going to stimulate a farmer, and that will stimulate the farmer's need to have electricity. And that will cause somehow in a bottom-up way, government to investing in electricity grids, because there's enough farmers now that have demand, and the demand somehow causes the government to act. And somehow that's just a how they've worked out the equation of how value works, or somebody who gets a debt to build something, they're told, well, that debt is equal whether you want to build a casino or a whorehouse, you know, might cost you $1 million, versus a debt to build a dam or a rail manufacturing plant, let's say, you know? So they're told, well, mathematically speaking, a debt is a debt. It's the same $1 million. The banks can use it, can securitize that, whatever. They can use that as collateral, equity, whatever that they want in their own practices. But the reality is that true? No. It's true if you're a mathematician and you don't look at qualities in the world. But if you're a human being, you know that there's the practices associated with the casino economy. Let's say all of America was induced to work like Vegas. Well, I guess it kind of is. But let's just say you just had all of the cities just adopt casinos and under a certain business model. Would that create a positive or negative net value for the society as a whole? Monetarily, you might get a lot of money, might be justifiable on that level for a short period of time. But who's producing the food? Who's maintaining your infrastructure, right? Where's the education for the next generation of better engineers and scientists going to come from? No one's thinking about that. So the question is really a matter of quality of value. And I think when you look at what China's doing and what they get a lot of it, there's a lot of attacks on China from a lot of the Western mainstream media rags, who are trying to sort of do a little Freudian psychological projection by telling us that they're creating debt slavery in all of the countries who are stupid enough to get on board with the Belt and Road Initiative. You know, for those who don't know, this is the Belt and Road Initiative, this, or New Silk Road. This is something which was announced in 2013. Today, there's almost 140 nations of the world who have signed on to the framework for this. It's a totally alternative banking model. There's different banks, Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, New Development Bank, Chinese Export Import Banks, many state banks are involved. It's built around a certain type of paradigm of win-win cooperation, of the idea that we can get our self-interest more guaranteed as investors if we're investing in things that allow participant countries, whether it's in Africa or whether it's in Asia or the Middle East or Europe, to develop and stand on their own two feet. Have real infrastructure that might be a little bit more patient. You have to wait maybe 5 or 10 or 20 years for these types of investments to begin to start producing monetary profit. So patience is important, as it should be for any gardener. You know, you have to wait till your garden starts producing some food. You can't just get it right away, the way some speculators on Wall Street would rather have it. But at the same time, it's a more truthful order of value versus the IMF World Bank practices that we saw people like John Perkins, you know, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman document, which is an intentional entrapment of countries from 1947 until really it goes on today, where any country who gets these IMF or World Bank loans is induced to take on conditionalities, which are designed to have the effect of not only hyperbolically increasing their debts so they could pay them back, and yet still within 20 years have 20 times more to pay, as we've seen from almost every third world country. And also it deprives them of the ability to have indigenous manufacturing and local controls of their banking or finance. There's no ability for a nation to stand on its own two feet. And it's really the same argument that Benjamin Franklin had with the British East India Company and the British financiers of London back in the 1720s, when he was writing on the necessity for paper currency, calling for and arguing for the right of the young colonies to be able to have access and develop their own local manufacturing. So the agricultural and the industrial worker could coexist. It's a much more efficient mode of organizing yourself, right? Rather than shipping your raw materials across the ocean so that the British monopolies could then transform it into usable goods to then send back horseshoes or hats or clothes or whatever to the colonies. That's a lot of wasted effort. And China, just like Benjamin Franklin, is of the view that we have more reliable partners if we encourage Nigeria or Kenya or Burma to start developing their own local infrastructure, their own manufacturing, and they're training new generations of engineers in Congo, in Sudan, to build the dams, to build the infrastructure. And it's not that these are practices that used to be more in harmony with America's self-conscious traditions under people like John F. Kennedy. And Franklin Roosevelt had the same view when he was meeting with world leaders in 1944 onward, preparing for the post-war age where it would be premised around certain common practices. I try to make the case that when you look at the Roosevelt grouping who wanted to export the New Deal, both in terms of banking reform as well as economic practice that was proven to be successful after 1933, and he wanted to internationalize this to give every nation the right to have access to these practices. It wasn't just American. They were meeting with the Chinese delegations who had signed on to a program for using America, using the early IMF, the World Bank that were being created to become instruments for international reconstruction finance corporations that would provide long-term low-interest loans, kind of like what today China's doing with the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank or the China Export-Import Banks, to provide those types of qualitative long-term loans for the development of the greening of the Sahara deserts, which Franklin Roosevelt is on record talking about in Libya, in Morocco. In Iran, he had projects also to help Iran, and the Shah loved these ideas of Iran. And you can only imagine if this hadn't been sabotaged, what type of amazing world could have occurred where people realized, in spite of their ideologies, but they had a common higher self-interest, which is not doctrinaire. It was based on national economics, national planning, and benefiting people. You know, people basically were able to take from the pie, but the pie was induced to grow both in quantity and in quality under these types of infrastructure projects. So that was sabotaged. When Roosevelt died, 45, a lot of his enemies, unfortunately, who he had done battle with for the 12, 13 years he was in power, increasingly permeated and took control of economic policy as well as foreign policy. Increasingly, we saw this real American system faction lose power in a very quick period of time from really 1945 to 48, 49. People like Paul Robeson, who worked with Wallace on his presidential campaign in 48, were basically labeled commie traitors and blacklisted. Their careers were either destroyed. Some of them died prematurely, and that's another discussion maybe. But there's definitely a coup process. And Eisenhower had a little bit of, you know, if you look at Eisenhower, he's a mixed bag. He was not a bad man. He was not part of the thing today people call deep state. He wasn't that. He didn't understand it either. He wasn't a politician. So there was a lot of influence of Roosevelt's enemies like John Foster Dulles, J. Edgar Hoover inside of the U.S. was growing the FBI under this period of the 50s. And he warned, you know, before with his famous military industrial complex speech after he met with Kennedy, and he really was warning the incoming administration and the people what it was that they had to be aware of that was causing them to lose their democracy completely. And JFK tried to push back against that. But he does it in a brilliant way, bringing in the Roosevelt fight against Wall Street. He has a program to shut down. In JFK's case, maybe he moved too soon, too fast. Maybe he was a bit naive, trying to take on the Federal Reserve as fast as he did by issuing silver-backed treasury notes. Maybe that was too soon. I don't know. But he had a multi-level project, both to an internal draining of the swamp, but also an external program, like I mentioned, with Kwame Nkrumah or with Patrice Lumumba of Congo and many other countries to help them develop their own national power to stand on their own two feet so that you could have fair trade with other partners of the world, rather than this monolithic, you know, unipolar system from above nations telling people what they're allowed to do or not do, as unfortunately we see coming out of a lot of the networks today around the Great Reset agenda. Yeah.
Very interesting topic.
Yeah.
Something we have to address. Yeah. You're a wealth of knowledge, and you've written a lot about what went wrong with the American system or how it got corrupted. Like also in the 19th century, not just World War II.
You know, I'm Canadian. And my book series on the Untold History of Canada was a really great exercise for me to that was my entry point in trying to sort of get a sense of what the hell is wrong with the world I've been born into. I was told going through the university system, through the high school system, that ultimately it's great that I'm not American. Thank God that we Canadians are not American. And we're just hammered and pummeled with this anti-American stuff from a very young age. And the theme tends to be, well, they were these selfish individualists who didn't want to have peace. They didn't want to pay their taxes to the overbearing but overall generous mother country. And they had their bloody rebellion, but we were smart and we stayed with the mother colony. And look, we've never had a revolution and we're free. So one of the biggest interesting entry points when you start looking at the sort of history that we're not told, and this is interesting for Americans too, was a friend of mine who used to be a professor at Université de Montréal. He had written in 2007 a wonderful essay on Benjamin Franklin in Montreal. And that got my attention because I was never told that Benjamin Franklin was here for several months before the in 1776. And when you actually look at what he was doing here with a small contingent of people from the Continental Congress, he was really working hard to organize as part of his grand strategy, getting the Quebec colony that had recently become a part of the British Empire after the Plains of Abraham and the Seven Years' War. He wanted them to be the 14th member to sign on to the Declaration of Independence. And he likely should have, if you think about it, there was a lot of empathy from the Quebecois to the plight of the Americans. And you would think from popular opinion, it should have happened. The problem I think he evaluated was the sophistication of British imperial grand strategy. And what he confronted was a very tightly controlled, again, I like the term deep state. I just think it's given people an additional thought complex in their lexicon. But he encountered an organizational structure that had been put here by the British that made it impossible from the top to get any cooperation. So one of the problems was people were told, the farmers and the other potential participants were told, if you join the American Revolution, you'll be excommunicated and burned in hell forever. Unfortunately, from the standpoint of a peasant Quebecois who largely, I mean, illiteracy was much higher in Quebec than it was in the United States colonies. The colonies were known, unlike in Europe, where they had a feudal system in Europe, your average person was not inclined to know how to read like the American Latin farmer was, you know, who could read their own Bible. They could read the classics. And that allowed for a greater capacity to think about, well, what are philosophically the right ideas of natural law that I should give my life for? That was available in the U.S. cultural matrix. And in many ways, that was because of Ben Franklin's work as a cultural warrior from, you know, 1720s onward with his Poor Richard's Almanac. And I mean, he did so many things with and science as well to really enhance and amplify the spiritual, cultural level so people could process those heavier ideas that they would need to if they were going to have the sort of revolution that he knew was possible, but it wasn't possible in 1720 or 30 or 40. And so people were afraid, oh, am I going to burn in hell forever for fighting with the Americans? And very few joined. There were some that did. And so the British were already thinking and preempting that, saying, okay, if you just stay loyal to us, we will allow you to have local political controls, local religious controls, but you have to stay loyal to the king. And unfortunately, most of them took that poison, and Benjamin Franklin sort of left empty-handed and did what he did.
So after 1944, do you want to say a bit about what went wrong and how we've gotten sunk into this neoliberal?
You had a certain cleansing, a cleaning of house at the same time that certain groupings that were loyal to a British imperial ordering of world society, they wanted a world that would be organized not by sovereign nation states, but rather by systems of supranational governance of experts from above, because the logic of these folks who are indoctrinated under a Rhodes scholarship or let's say a Fabian Society conditioning in the London School of Economics, there's a certain type of recruitment policy within the elites who are sort of filtered through, and some of them are encouraged to be a part of a certain way of thinking. So what happened from 1946 to 1971 was a system where, okay, Keynesian and top-down planning happened, but there wasn't a lot of the actual political economic vision involved in it. JFK tried to channel it towards doing big projects, space, water projects in America, beyond. But overall, it was more about just constricting and controlling the levers in a very administrative way from a top-down central banking planning structure. It wasn't really very visionary. It wasn't very American system in that sense. And increasingly, the Bretton Woods system was made weaker and weaker as the U.S. went into more of a consumer modality of behavior. We had this sort of new age of increasingly Austrian school, the Mont-Pèlerin Society, the Austrian school thinking of neoliberalism became more and more hegemonic, liberalize the markets, privatize a whole bunch of state-run enterprises, cut social spending. And then this was increasingly brought online in the late 70s under Reaganomics and Thatcherism, which resulted in the Big Bang, just deregulate everything, just let it go. Let pirates have social Darwinism to the nth degree, and let the strong beat out the poor in this race for diminishing returns and free for all. So that was the party that's now coming to an end.
So how do we keep currencies from being exploited? We have a functional system that's fair to all.
Well, I think your writings have been really wonderful in that direction. I think anybody who really wants to think about serious problem solving instead of endless bickering about bottom up versus top down or whatever should really, I mean, take some of the work that you've been producing over these years seriously, because I think that, yeah, it's in every nation's, if you're a sovereign nation, it's your sovereign right to have a national bank. You don't have to have private supranational financiers telling your government what's allowed to do or not do, economically speaking. And it doesn't mean you have to be a dictatorship. It doesn't mean that free markets or private enterprise has to be quashed. In fact, looking at history, every time this was done with the correct way of thinking and heart in mind, it always resulted in the enhancement of private sector growth and real development. And I think that today, I mean, people have to accept this scary truth that I think that our intellects sometimes create a firewall from thinking about because it's scary. Maybe we feel disempowered, but the financial system as we are living under it in the transatlantic is a bubble that's going to blow. Conservative estimates have this at anywhere between 780 trillion to $1.5 quadrillion of derivatives assets, you know, like these speculative claims on securitized debts that are gambled upon and insured upon and then sub-gambled upon, and it's infinitely divisible, and it's a chimera. You have to look at the fact that the banks are going to collapse. The banking system is going to default. The value is not going to be worth much of anything. And the only thing that people that will have value is what sustains your life. That has real value. So you need things like what Roosevelt did, number one, in his first 100 days. You got to use that as a serious role model. You know, things like Glass-Steagall. And I know you've endorsed this for years. Get Glass-Steagall in, break up the speculators and let them take their own losses. Stop bailing them out, but protect the commercial banks and use that protection to reorganize the payable from unpayable debts the way Roosevelt did with his bank holiday, right? You got to let some banks collapse. It's a fact. But the banks that are going to be solvent are going to be reorganized under a federal mandate to reinvest the way you documented in your new article through some form of national banking practice, whether it's a form of Reconstruction Finance Corporation of the 21st century or whatever. You got to get national credit into investments, into infrastructure. You got to get people loans. You got to support people from their foreclosures. Farms are going to foreclose. We're already at a high point of farm foreclosures that's causing a very great danger of a massive food crisis that's already bad. It's not going to be a gradual, slow, things are just going to kind of just gradually get worse. There is a breaking point that's going to hit like a shock. People have to think, okay, who's going to take the brunt of that shock? Who's going to take the pain? Is it going to be the people? Because that's what the Great Reset crowd wants. They want to put the pain on the people, and they're willing to take financial losses by like 95%. They're willing to do that as long as their political power is going to increase over the people. Thank God for China and Russia, because honestly, were it not for the multipolar alliance that's created this alternative economic system in the East, that's an open system offering olive branches after olive branches for us to join and work with in harmony. If that wasn't there, I'd be a lot more depressed. And I'm still not happy, but I'd be a lot more depressed. So there is a way of just simply looking at the fact that, okay, these countries are doing the things that we used to do successfully, and now they're the only ones doing it. And they're offering us chances to work with them. And I think that those chances are not going to be taken away by their will, but I think that there's a lot of bad thinking that's very hegemonic amongst Western governments, and the people have to become more courageous and strong-minded about their history and how they're being manipulated into these false polarizations.
Yeah, we have to figure out some way to all come together. It's been the art of war for centuries that you divide people and pit them against each other, because they, whoever they are, we way outnumber them. If we could get together, we win. It's obvious we win with a truly democratic system before right. They manage to get a control system in that we can't break out of. Working out the details is very tricky. It seems to me that we should have a look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you've got food and shelter and all that as the bottom rung. That should be covered by the government, I would say. You know, that should be your safety net. You can't fall below that. You're not going to be literally out in the street. People say, well, if you had a universal basic income, then people wouldn't work. or it'll come with strings attached, and then you'll have totalitarian rule from the top, and we don't want either of those. But it seems to me if that's not going to be enough money to really do anything interesting. I mean, people want more money than that. So they will definitely get out there and build their own business or whatever, get a job. And, you know, they want a nice house. They want to travel and all those other things that aren't going to be covered with a modest universal basic income. But know that we have some sort of safety net. It does seem like that should be. I always think of the human body as the ideal model. And so we get all these cells to work together.
Nature is different, you know. Right now, we've been feeding the cancer with bailouts. We've been feeding culturally the worst elements of our thinking, of our presumption, like our prejudices. This has been consciously politically fed to grow this cancer at the expense of the healthy tissue of the body of humanity for a very long time. And at a certain point, we have to decide, like, let's maybe stop doing that. Let's empower our white blood cells. Let's and rehabilitate. So yeah, your metaphor of the human body and economy is, I think, really, it's good.
So it's just been great talking to you, Matthew. You're a fund of knowledge. And it's interesting to me that you know so much about our system, the American system.
It was super, super nice to be on. And thank you for having me as a guest.
Ellen has been speaking with Matthew Arrett, a noted political economist and historian. You can find his extensive commentaries on world politics and economics at CanadianPatriot.org. And now you can see some of It's Our Money's programs on YouTube. And of course, through our podcast address, itsourmoney.podbean.com. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money.